So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
The Lux Express has stopped in suburban Detroit. The Lux Express has stopped in Auburn Hills. The Lux Express has stopped in the Palace. The Lux Express has stopped at Hunter Class.
Welcome to Review Away, everybody. My name is John Pollock, joined by Wei Ting. How are you doing today, Wei?
I'm so tired.
I was, like, so energetic this morning. I just hit a wall in the last half hour.
Yeah.
You're having coffee. I, meanwhile, I'm having water. When does that happen?
Never. I've never seen you drink water.
It's good for you.
It is. It absolutely is. It's nature's...
gift?
Yes.
It's a natural resource.
I was going to say nature's blood.
But, mine is, you know what is not so natural, though? It says here natural spring water. Then it says dissolved mineral, salts, 290 ppm, fluoride ions, 0 ppm, oxygenated, non-carbonated, source at Feversham, Grey County, Ontario. That doesn't sound like anything nature gave me.
It says zero, though. It means there's none of that.
But 290 ppm of mineral salts. Dissolved mineral salts.
Okay. I don't know what that does. Maybe it's good for you.
Maybe it is.
Salts.
Dissolved mineral salts.
Do you like salt, John?
You know what? I'm not a big fan of salt, to be honest.
I never was.
What? What's so wrong about this?
I'm just laughing because this is just like... We're hitting new levels of tangents on this podcast.
Do you know how seriously like contingent we are when it comes to salt? It's in everything, dude. Everything.
Absolutely, I know that. You know what? I absolutely do know that, and I know that more now because my parents are getting older, and they're realizing that salt is really bad for you, particularly if you have high blood pressure.
Oh, yeah.
So they're doing everything, you know, they're doing as much as they can to kind of avoid salt. And it's very difficult, especially when you're eating out, you know. You have to ask them sometimes specifically to give you less salt in your food.
I went to this, like, nice restaurant back in, like, February, and I came home that night, and it was funny. Like, you're not... thirsty at all, and it's directly proportionate to like how much salt a lot of these restaurants put in food, and that's why you get so thirsty like later on, because you've taken in all the salt.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like what all these restaurants use to just kind of add flavor to it, and you're suffering from it. You're gonna get all this shit later in life.
And
corn and salt, dude, like you have no idea how much we rely on this stuff.
Corn?
Oh yeah, dude, corn is in everything. Look at the ingredients next time. It's like corn starch. It's like corn has become like this gigantic commodity.
I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah. Corn and salt, man. Like our world would be so much better without it, but it's such a gigantic moneymaker. It'd be like get rid of tobacco next.
I think some is good. Everything in moderation.
Sure, everything in moderation, but it's not in moderation. I guarantee in a week, I would say 80% of the things you digest have corn in them. Some form or fashion.
80% of things.
Dude, I just drank water here that has fucking dissolved salt in it. How the fuck would I have known?
There's no corn in there.
There isn't corn in there, but the salt.
Yes. So then you'll get even more thirsty after drinking your water.
Man. Everything's a trick. Everything's a fucking game. Just to get you to have more.
To swerve.
It's never enough.
It's
never enough.
That's right.
So...
oh, my God.
Speaking of things that left a bad taste in my mouth, SummerSlam 1993.
Nice.
The Palace of Auburn Hills. Now, for those of you that listened on Monday for Review of Raw, we had a number of issues. This guy I know like slept through the entire show.
Yeah.
That was the least of the problems, though, by the end of the night.
Very unprofessional.
We finished the show at, like, what time did we finish this? Like, 2 in the morning?
Probably.
Roughly, give or take a few minutes.
Yeah.
And I was so upset because I realized that we had gotten bumped off at one point, which is always a fun part of the live shows, is when one of us, well, you continue talking to realize I'm not there. That would drive me nuts if I knew every time I'm talking, you might not respond.
Yeah,
I know. It happens twice a show. I hate it.
It happens all the time. And, well, I guess you all got to hear how...
Anyway, so we got knocked off. And for whatever reason, this has never happened before, the recording program stopped recording at that point and didn't continue recording. We've never had this issue before. So, got back on the line. We continued the show for another, like, 90 minutes. And at the end, it had recorded 13 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost punched my computer.
Yeah.
Like, I was really, really down on it. And you were just like, okay, well, we'll do it in the morning. So give me a chance to watch it all. You didn't even, like, fucking blink an eye about, let's do this again tomorrow.
Yeah, I know. Well, partly because I hadn't watched the show, and I wasn't too happy with, you know, the review and how it came across. So I kind of saw the positive side of things and thought that I'd be able to watch it and then, you know, give a proper review the next day.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we've been through this before where we've had to...
But it's been a long time.
No, the last time was probably in May.
Was it?
Yeah.
We had to redo it?
Yeah. Remember the TNA review? One of the Impact reviews that you did at my house? Right before we went to
Nineveh? Oh, Jesus, that one.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. When we first got our new mics and stuff, yeah, we were having issues with that.
And you guys will probably never knew about that, but yes.
That's right. We did two fucking
shows. This stuff happens.
That.
And whenever it happens, your heart sinks, okay? But what can you do? You just forget about it and move on. That's the best thing you can do.
Well, we got our ass saved by Henzo Flores,
mm-hmm.
who was listening live and recorded the whole thing. I was just blown away because I got off the phone with you and I was up for like another 20 minutes or so. And I was just like, fuck, like, when are we going to record this on Tuesday? Because you and I had a shoot to go out and do. And
yeah.
It's like, we're not going to have any time to do this. And it's like, everyone's going to be waiting for the show. And when are we going to do this? And then I got a text from you that a guy had saved it. And I thought you were fucking with me. It's like, this is not funny at all right now, like, to just play with me.
It's not my sense of humor.
No, it's not. And the guy seriously saved it.
Mm-hmm.
And he posted it up. I downloaded it. And I saw 25 megabytes. I'm like, this is a small file for how long we recorded. This is going to sound like shit. And I listened to it, and it was fucking great. Sounded great. It was all there. He was like, all I missed was the beginning. Well, I'm like, I'm covered for 13 minutes. This
yeah.
thing, if you went and listened back way, like, I always cut out where we get knocked off. Fucking seamless, I will say.
Oh, yeah? Nice.
Like,
good
if
job.
You had not heard us get knocked off, I don't think you could pick out the points where the drop-offs were.
Okay.
So I was extremely happy. And then Tuesday, I come home, and I'm about to finish up SummerSlam, because I watch, like, an hour of it on the weekend. In all of this, when we record these shows... Like, there's all these files, there's all these MP3s on my desktop, there's notes for Raw and shit, and I hate a cluttered desktop. And I just blow out all this shit. Unfortunately, one of the things I deleted were my SummerSlam notes. And apparently, my options on my recycling bin are to fucking delete shit instantly.
Because
it was gone from my recycling bin, and I'm like, are you kidding me? I am not rewatching an hour of this event. Because it was pretty bad up until this point.
Wow.
So I've got random notes from the first hour, but you're going to have to help me a bit.
Sure. I'll do
so
my
best. That's the preface, everybody, to SummerSlam 93.
Not a good week for computers.
Oh, man. Stuff just going wrong.
Yeah.
Just going wrong. But all in all, I think we're going to end up ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. We should just upload all our notes and everything that we do to our listeners so that they will have backups.
You suggested this. We should just take notes, like, on... public forum.
Yeah.
People can see what we're writing. Mm-hmm. WWF SummerSlam 1993, August. Traditional month for SummerSlam. Wei Ting, do you remember the Lex Express?
I do. I do remember. Of course, you know, being in Canada, I always felt like I had missed out on this. I felt quite removed from it, first of all, just because I was Canadian and here was this TV show touting Americanism. And I felt quite detached, I have to say.
I called into the wrestling line on Starphone, like, every week to hear updates if the Lex Express was going to come through my city in Canada. Of course not. Lex Luger hates non-Americans.
Yeah, you want it to be American.
Oh, before we get into the full review, coming up later in this show, we're going to air an interview we did with Lex Luger from 2010.
Nice.
This is quite the interview. We had him on once in like 2005, and this interview was atrocious. I don't want to make accusations, but it seemed like Lex Luger was not all there. And then we had him back on last year, and we didn't know what to expect, but he had cleaned himself up, and this interview was awesome. It was one of the best interviews of last year.
Cool.
So we're going to play that for you coming up later, so you can hear about Lex Luger, update on his health, and just kind of all the stuff he was going through with all the drug problems. Extremely open about stuff, so that's going to come up later in the show.
Okay.
But let's chat about this way. Your announcers for the evening, Vince McMahon and Bobby Heenan. And the show started off with a recap of Lex's bus tour throughout the U.S. and a great Vince McMahon opening, as usual, for these pay-per-views.
Oh, Vince was going nuts.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah. And, of course, Jerry Lawler was supposed to be wrestling on this show. Wasn't he doing a regular commentary by this point for all the pay-per-views? At the King of the Ring, he was, wasn't he? That's what led to the angle at the end?
Yeah, I think so.
And so Bobby Heenan comes back here to replace him.
I wonder what Heenan was doing at this time. I guess
wrestling.
I don't
challenge.
Think he was doing superstars. Might have
not
just
sure.
been doing like challenge and stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we start things off with Razor Ramon against the $1 Million Man Ted DiBiase. And DiBiase was winding down his career here. He was going to need neck surgery, which made the finish of this match a bit curious.
This was actually his last match in the WWE.
Yes. Finished up here. Lots of rest holds with DiBiase having the heat. DiBiase eventually took the pad off the top turnbuckle, but it was Razor Ramon who sent DiBiase into the turnbuckle, and then he hits the razor's edge onto the damaged neck of Ted DiBiase for the finish. And they gave these guys like 7.5 minutes.
Yeah, this was pretty decent, I thought. And it was about as clean and rudimentary as you can get for a match. Razor here had just recently turned babyface after losing to the 1-2-3 Kid, who ended up beating DiBiase as well with the help of Razor, which led to this program. And I felt the crowd was really behind Razor Ramon.
Yeah, they were getting behind him as a babyface. I thought this match was just, you know, it was fine.
It was him on his way up and DiBiase on his way down.
They promoted the 1-900 hotline, where you could call in and talk to wrestlers and get in on a conference call with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they showed The Undertaker taking calls, and a caller asked what his thoughts were about Hulk Hogan and Jake Roberts, who are not with the company anymore. And as Undertaker went to answer, Heenan spoke over The Undertaker's answer, just to entice you to call in and find out what The Undertaker thinks of Hulk Hogan.
I think they cut this out of the version I watched.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
I got this on the, I can't remember where it was. I think this was on the DVD.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Then they show the Steiner brothers' mother and sister at ringside. Did you see this?
I did.
My goodness. I talked about Vince McMahon's tan. The Steiner's sister here was orange, like dark orange.
Yeah, well.
A lot of tanning in Michigan.
I guess so. They're known for their beaches out in Michigan. She calls Rick
Rob.
Yeah.
His real name.
Rob and Scott. That's how she refers to
the
them.
The dog-faced gremlin Rob Steiner.
Yeah, fine.
And that leads us to our next matchup, the Steiner brothers defending the tag titles against the Heavenly Bodies. The Steiners wearing the Michigan State colors here as they were in their home state.
They wore them for the whole WWE run, I think.
Those colors?
Yeah, or at least those jackets.
Oh, the jackets they always had, but I think they changed up the singlets.
Okay.
The match starts with the Heavenly Bodies attacking the Steiners from behind, and a nasty landing flapjack spot to Rick Steiner. I thought I was watching Impact from this past week.
Yeah.
Attack from behind and then a fucked up flapjack.
Yeah.
Double team flapjack. I can say I'm not a fan of this move after watching two people nearly die in 48 hours.
Oh, we've
missed Tassmacher and Rick Steiner.
Okay.
There was Jimmy Del Rey took this insane back body drop here. This guy could bump.
Yeah.
And of course, this was when Smoky Mountain Wrestling and WWF had a working relationship, and Cornette was running Smoky Mountain and managing here.
I remember just really disliking Jimmy Del Rey because I always just thought he looked like a real pervert.
Well, he was the gigolo. Jimmy Del Rey.
Yeah.
That was his gimmick, way. Creepy looking redneck.
Not really a redneck.
Well, he was, if you ever heard him talk.
Oh, he is? Okay. Well, and he has sex for money? Is that the guy?
His nickname was the Gigolo, so yes, that would mean he fucks people for money.
Okay.
He was the original Val Venus. We see a double underhook suplex by Scott delivered to Pritchard, makes the hot tag to Rick, and then Rick hits a top rope bulldog, Pritchard makes the save, and then Pritchard hits Rick with a racket shot with Jim Cornette's tennis racket, only a near fall. Then Del Rey, he goes for a moonsault, but Pritchard is holding up Rick. Now, this is one of those moves where had Del Rey hit this move, he would have clobbered his partner. In fact, Rick would have landed on top of his partner. So, really poor thought process here. Nonetheless, Rick got out of the way, and Del Rey hit Pritchard anyway. And then Scott hits the Frankensteiner to Del Rey, and they get the win 9 minutes and 28 seconds.
Well,
Frankensteiner finish.
Odd moves aside, I thought Scott looked great. He was very mobile at this time, and the Heavenly Bodies looked very good as well. Rick, I thought, looked pretty sloppy in some of his moves, some of his offense.
And this was one of the... This might have been the best match of the night.
Could have been. Crowd certainly went home very happy.
Then we go to an interview with Shawn Michaels and Diesel. And Diesel informs us that all the chicks want Shawn, and his job is to keep them away. Mm-hmm. So our next matchup, Shawn Michaels against Mr. Perfect for the Intercontinental title.
By the way, this was Mean Gene's last pay-per-view with the company
yes,
as well.
Yes, it was. He did the voiceover at the start, and then he...
He did some Coliseum home video stuff.
Exclusives.
Yes.
So...
He was replaced by John Fowler.
Joe Fowler. Broadcaster extraordinaire, as he was introduced.
Joe Fowler.
Joe Fowler had some moments on this show. Michaels is dumped to the floor by Perfect with a catapult. Michaels then hits a super kick on the floor after Diesel distracts Mr. Perfect. Back in the ring, Perfect hits the Perfect Plex, but Diesel breaks up the cover. They fight on the floor. Perfect's thrown into the post by Diesel and gets counted out once I think the ref misses because he had been knocked down. They only went like 11-20 here. On paper, you'd think this match would have been off the charts. I was really disappointed with this match.
I thought it was good. I really enjoyed it. It was a good old-school feel type of match. Why were you disappointed?
I just thought these guys, it was just very by-the-basics wrestling match. I had higher expectations for these two in the ring together. It was a lame finish.
I thought there were some pretty fantastic sequences that were done very well. This, of course, you know, was marred by the... lack of real finish, but I thought, you know, nothing flashy, but just real good work with the basics here.
Diesel lays out Perfect after the match, then Perfect regains consciousness, chases them to the back, and in a Coliseum home video exclusive, Oakland's talking to Michaels and Diesel, and then Hennig attacks both of them, uses a table, and eventually officials break them up, including Bill Alfonso and Shane McMahon.
Mm-hmm.
Not to nitpick here, but we've reviewed WrestleMania 9, where Lex Luger knocks out Mr. Perfect after their match, and then afterwards, Perfect regains consciousness, storms to the back, and brawls with Shawn Michaels and Lex Luger. It was, like, identical to this finish, and this was in between, there was one pay-per-view in between those.
Uh-huh.
A little...
Well, they hate each other so much, they do their brawling
the
in the back.
Finish. All right.
Well, this was a Coliseum exclusive, I'm
That's
guessing.
That's true. Only Coliseum home video subscribers saw this.
I really didn't mind it. I mean, I didn't necessarily think about that WrestleMania finish right away. But I actually thought this was when backstage attacks make sense, you know?
Well, because you never saw them. It was a whole new venue to see. You never went backstage on a WWF broadcast.
Sure. And also, you know, this happens after... the heel does something mean to the babyface, and the babyface is actually angry. I mean, unlike TNA, where backstage brawls break up for no reason.
Forever. If I was booking TNA right now, I would not do one backstage angle for like a year.
Okay.
Because I'm so desensitized to it, and they look like shit, too.
You mean fighting backstage, or
yeah.
Are you talking about like...
I'm fine with like promo segments backstage, but not like full out... You know, you see how many each show.
Yeah, I know.
That's a great point you make here, is that this this was different in 1993.
And it was like five times shorter than what a knockout brawl would be.
Then we went to the most nervous interview in history. The 123 Kid and brand new commentator Joe Fowler. And 123 Kid discusses the butterflies that he has. Says he's too nervous to talk. And then he starts dumping out cliches. I'm going to give it 110%. I'm going to throw caution to the wind. And then, in a superstar-making statement from Joe Fowler, he says, folks, he's quiet, he's shy, but he's a hero. Oh, was this lame. And I'm sure Waltman was told, act nervous.
Yeah, that was
and boy, did he accomplish that here.
Yeah, it was his first pay-per-view. It was very interesting. How far has this man come in 18 years from... you know, being the geeky teenager to reviewing Raw from his bedroom, which I really enjoy. I like his reviews.
It's great. And that takes us to our next match, IRS against the 123 Kid.
IRS cuts a promo before the match. He says, Detroit is usually known as the Motor City, but now it is known as... the tax cheat city.
Boo! How dare you say I don't pay my taxes?
I don't get it. It doesn't even rhyme.
Tax cheat city. Wow. It wasn't one of the big pay-per-views. He wasn't being too creative.
Okay.
This match was 5 minutes of IRS getting the heat.
Mm-hmm.
There was an abdominal stretch.
Vince is in full cliche mode for this match. He's like... you do it best. One, two. He's got him.
He had a great one in the main event.
Yeah.
He was great at these. It's over. No, kick out.
There it is. That's what I wanted. Heenan said, it was hilarious in this match. He's like, this is the first. This is the first time the kid has been up past 8 o'clock.
It's very funny.
He's so funny.
Heenan
really
was really funny on this show for a number of different areas. IRS goes over here.
Yeah.
What was the point? 123 Kid's coming off that Razor Ramon win.
Also a DiBiase win as well.
IRS?
Yeah, but...
this guy was nothing.
I completely agree with you. I guess their thinking was that, you know, you had come to expect that this guy would be getting upset wins all the time, so it wouldn't make much sense. It wouldn't be so realistic for him
to
get
IRS?
Upset.
I mean, put him in there with a heel that has
true.
Something.
I don't know.
I thought the booking here was really dumb.
I don't really know. I thought Waltman was really, really over with the crowd.
I did too.
He does an awesome job with the, you know, like, especially with his pins. Anytime he would go and roll up for a pin, he would kind of, you know, struggle and almost act as if, you know, he was always really close to you know, being overpowered from the pinfall. I really enjoyed that.
Who knew that this little kid would one day perform in One Night in China?
Oh, man. Yeah.
Then we move on, and, I didn't know this next interview segment was coming, Way. But we go to Todd Pettengill at ringside with Owen and Bruce Hart.
Yes, what a great surprise.
Home run here. And they talk about Stu just having knee surgery. And they explain that it's all Jerry Lawler's fault because our dad was so upset leaving Raw after Lawler made some comments to Helen that he left the arena upset and twisted his knee because of his anger leaving Raw. Jerry Lawler is culpable for this. Your words upset our father and he twisted his knee and needed reconstructive knee surgery. This was great. Stu just looked, Bruce just looked like Bruce Kane.
Yes, and Bruce, wasn't he in line? Like, wasn't he campaigning for a role with the company at
this
time?
This was at the point when they were probably in the early stages of discussing the angle that one of the Harts was going to turn on Brett, and Patterson really was lobbying for Bruce.
Mm-hmm.
And Bruce was going to get the spot, and Brett was the one who nixed it, saying, no, Bruce won't work. I want to do this with Owen.
Yep.
And Bruce always held that against Brett for taking away his big break.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
I can't say I disagree with Brett's decision. Owen, I thought, was a much more dynamic performer and fit the role a lot better than Bruce.
Younger as well.
Yes.
Who knows? Who knows what would have happened?
So that takes us to our next match. Jerry Lawler comes out on crutches, and Heenan admits he was aware of this, but he couldn't say anything all night. And Todd Pettengill asks Lawler, what's going on? And Lawler says he hates the whole Hart family. He hates all of these people. He got off on a plane, rented a car. The radio didn't work. The brakes didn't work. And the airbags didn't work. And an old lady pulled out in front of him and caused a 10-car pileup. And Heenan then guesses it must have been Helen. And Lawler said he had to pull himself out of the fiery wreckage and says he can beat Hart with one leg, but the doctors are not going to allow him to compete tonight. And he has appointed his personal court jester, Doink the Clown, to take his place.
I thought Lawler was hilarious.
Lawler was very funny here.
He was great at telling the story of renting this car and getting injured.
So we get Bret Hart against Doink the Clown on pay-per-view.
On pay-per-view, absolutely.
Imagine when you think about this. The year before, Bret Hart was in Wembley Stadium taking on British Bulldog. And a year later, he was selling for Doink the Clown.
Well, anyway.
Doink came down and had the highlight of the fucking pay-per-view for me. And you know exactly what I'm talking about, Wei.
Yeah.
He had this bucket of confetti that he was throwing on fans, and then he went to pour the bucket onto Bruce, but instead of confetti, there was water.
Yeah.
1,000% I will guarantee you they did not tell Bruce this was coming. 1,000% I guarantee you. Because this guy looked livid, absolutely livid, that they got water all over his suit.
Heenan loses it on commentary.
It was so funny.
Laughing at Bruce, and we were all laughing with him. This is so awesome.
If you are ever visiting a WWE event in a cameo appearance like a Jim Ross or Bruce Hart, never wear a new suit or something nice, because they are going to fuck with you. And I guarantee that's what happened here. I don't even have to ask anybody if this was a legit swerve on Bruce. I howled, because it didn't play into anything later on, really. It was just Doink being an asshole.
No, it was just to get heat.
I loved this.
This is part of Doink's gimmick. I loved Evil Doink.
The heel Doink was great. I loved his theme music.
The music was awesome. I thought the dude's facials were great.
Like, he was a scary fucking character.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome name, too. Doink. I like it. It's a
then
classic.
Then he brought in all the midgets and went babyface, and he got so lame.
Mm-hmm.
Even some of the names of his finishes that they called in this match, which we will get to, are just great. So the match starts off. It's all Bret here. Doink gets sent to the floor. He catches Doink on the top rope and crotches him, then drives him face first into the mat. Owen, you can catch him doing ringside commentary, where the camera would just go to him, and Owen's in character the whole time, where you can just hear him, leave a piece for me, beat his brains in. Like these taunts you would get on like fucking WrestleMania, the video game on Sega Genesis. Hart then goes for Lawler, and Doink hits a flying knee, and this is when Doink gets the heat. Doink uses an STF as fans chant for Hart.
I couldn't believe this. A very technical Doink.
A very technical Doink.
Matt Bourne
at this time. And he did this move where he sat on the shoulders of a seated Bret, lifted his leg up, and this was called the stunt puller.
The stump puller.
Stunt or stump?
Stump.
Stump puller.
Yeah, the stump puller.
Wouldn't stunt puller be more?
No, I think this is an actual move. It's not just a doink
never,
the clown move.
Never heard of this.
It's like an inverted Boston crab.
I'm talking about a different spot.
I'm talking about this. Yeah, no, the one that nearly got him the victory. He was working on the leg, and then Bret got the ropes. Right,
he lifts the leg up in the air.
Yeah.
How's that an inverted Boston crab?
Because a Boston crab,
an inverted Boston crab would be the Billy Goat's curse.
No, because when you say a move is inverted, it means the victim is flipped, not the attacker. Like an inverted DDT would be, the armpit, like the person's face facing your armpit. All anyway, right. Big book of wrestling moves.
Man,
check it out.
I thought you were going to bust out like a cosine reference here to explain the dynamics and the psychology.
Big book of wrestling
moves. The
stump puller.
By Doink. Then he went for the bombs away off the top rope, which I'm sure Ray Stevens was contemplating once calling the whoopee cushion.
I think that I just loved his moveset. I loved everything about Evil Dawn.
There were a lot of characters on the show. Granted, the work on this show, this was 93. It was really a far cry from great. There were a few good workers, but all of these characters, not all of them, but a good portion of them, they did moves that fit their characters.
Yeah.
As racist as it was, the head shrinkers didn't sell anything with their head. Mm-hmm. Who was it? It was the smoking guns. They would do all these moves like a bulldog, and he didn't even talked it up about how these guys are cowboys and they use bulldogs and stuff. And this stuff never dawned on me before, but watching this, it was like the characters did moves that fit their characters.
Totally, totally, totally.
Big fan of that.
Absolutely.
Anyway, we get a elbow off the second rope and then into the sharpshooter. Brett applies it, but then Lawler breaks it up as he runs into the ring and attacks Brett with his crutch. And then it's delivered to the back of Brett, beats him down with the crutch as Bruce and Owen try to get into the ring. And then Lawler helps Doink to the back. Everyone thinks this is over, but then Jack Tunney comes out and he orders Lawler to wrestle. And Howard Finkel announces that if Lawler doesn't wrestle, he will be banned from the WWF. Now, Vince started yelling over Finkel's announcement at the end, but it sounded like he said he will be banned for a month.
Yeah, it did sound like that, but I'm pretty sure he said banned from the WWF.
All right.
Banned for life or something. Right. Banned for a month.
Month, okay. See you at Survivor Series.
Yeah.
So, Hart attacks Lawler, and then we get the match as promised. They did not bait and switch here. Hart starts biting Lawler, beats him down with punches, delivers a back body drop. Then he attacks him with his crutch on the floor.
And there's no DQ.
Yeah, apparently not. There was a lot of... And it was all officiating on this show.
And it was all from Bill Alfonso.
Yeah, well, he's the extreme referee.
I guess so.
Lawler then cuts him off with his own crutch shots and drops Lawler and chokes him with the crutch. There was a great spot as Lawler snuck in with the crutch hidden, and he gets the referee to focus on Bruce and Owen by pointing. And they cut over to Bruce and Owen, who are just yelling at the ref, "Turn around!" And Bruce puts his fingers up, "Look!" And he puts these circles around his eyes, "Look!" Fuck, was Bruce Hart not the best person on this entire show? I want Bruce Hart. I take it back. I wish Bruce got a prolonged run in the WWF.
Me too.
Because this guy did all these little things that I just loved.
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
It's because we've got to spend time with Bruce Hart.
Yeah.
This guy, was that not your highlight of WrestleMania 26?
Absolutely.
You
it was.
And I went nuts when they announced the special guest referee, Bruce Hart.
Yeah. We went nuts, and then once Bruce was stepping over him, I think we texted each other just marking out.
Oh man.
Yeah, it was great.
So I laughed so hard here.
Bruce is going nuts here.
Oh, the look.
Yeah.
Hart fights back after taking his own straps down, which is a Lawler spot out of Memphis. Then he hits the pile driver onto Jerry Lawler, which really hadn't been established by Lawler in the WWF. So the context was kind of lost here of Hart using Lawler's own finish. And then from there, Hart goes into the sharpshooter, and the bell is called, but Hart will not release the hold. And all the officials are in the ring trying to get Hart off of him. Owen comes into the ring, and he's wearing these black leather pants tucked into the top of his cowboy boots.
No, that's the look, I guess.
That's the 93 look.
Yeah.
And finally, Brett releases the hold, but the referee has reversed the decision as a result of the hold not being let go, and Lawler wins by disqualification and is ruled the undisputed king of the WWF. I thought all of this was really solid. Mm-hmm. The crowd was into this. This was like a half hour segment, of Hart being out there with Lawler.
And the program continues.
Yeah.
You know?
The finality really, they kind of dropped this off because Lawler had to leave the company for a bit with that rape accusation turned out to be bullshit.
Yeah.
But then he would come back and, I mean, that Kiss My Foot match wasn't until 95.
Yeah.
They really didn't revisit it in 94 at all.
No.
They just kind of kept this lingering feud in the background.
It's too bad. But for me, you know, like anytime I get to see Brett in his prime with any of these tapes, it's a real pleasure. Just watching the guy deliver, you know, just basic offense, like a punch or a kick. Everything is just executed so perfectly. It looks like it, you know, it looks crisp, and you can also tell that it's perfectly safe. So I enjoy watching Bret matches.
92 to 97, you're gonna be hard pressed to find a bad Bret Hart match. Mm-hmm. Like, especially when he had time on pay per view. Like, I don't know. That's always the debate. Was in the 90s, was it Bret or Misawa that was the top worker? And I just always leaned towards Bret, mainly because I grew up on it. But mm-hmm. I just, such a great storyteller in the ring, and it's just,
yeah,
it, you just get sucked into his matches so
mm-hmm.
easily.
Mm-hmm.
So great stuff here from everyone involved here, with a special tip to Bruce Hart here, who is big asset to this entire
Absolutely.
Ordeal. So afterwards, we go backstage. Shawn Michaels, Diesel, and IRS are on the hotline. And Kim from Massachusetts asks Shawn, did Marty Jannetty give you much of a challenge? And Michael says, I carried that team. And then he says, Jannetty is going to be the Jannetty of our team.
Wow.
No, he didn't say that. Then they go to a pre-taped promo of Ludwig Borga. Tony Halm,
mm-hmm.
Randy Couture's first UFC opponent.
That's correct.
From 97. And Ludwig is in the slums of Detroit, cuts a promo on Lex Luger, mocking poverty and pollution, and saying that the Lex Express never stopped in this area, and he's going to take an opportunity tonight to show people what he is all about. I was actually a fan of Ludwig Borga. He was the first, him and Bam Bam Bigelow were the first heels I got into as a
really?
Kid who I really liked.
Wow, what and was it about Ludwig Borga?
I don't know. I think just the way he talked, I was like, all this guy wants to do is like clean up garbage. It's like, what's so wrong with this guy?
He's foreign. That's what.
Well, if there's one thing I took away from SummerSlam 93, how dare you be born outside of the United States? Because we would see some offensive shit later in this show.
Mm.
So then we go to Marty Jannetty against Ludwig Borga. Ooh, yeah. This was on pay-per-view. Borga, his offense consisted of punches to the ribs of Jannetty. And his gimmick was he could punch hard. And he then delivered some punches and knees. There's a giant press slam by Borga. And then as Jannetty is falling from the sky, Borga punches him upon landing in the rib, and they mark out for this on commentary. And Vince refers to him as the Scandinavian deadlift champion. Then Borga applies a bear hug, big lariat that Jannetty sells for. Then Jannetty gets a bit of a hope spot with two super kicks and a cross body off the second turnbuckle, but he is caught, slammed down, and then Borga applies the torture rack, and the referee yells, "Ring the damn bell!"
No. Uh-huh.
That was the finish.
Pretty straightforward.
Ludwig Borga. And they played up in this match that Ludwig Borga has been undefeated for 2 months, but Tatanka has a much longer undefeated streak. So didn't have to be a scientist to realize the direction they were going.
Yes, that's right. And Marty Jannetty pretty much on his way to nowhere.
Yeah, on the road to one of many, many firings with the WWF
yes.
throughout his career. Then, did you get the Survivor Series promo here?
No, I didn't.
What a great
Tell
promo.
Me about it.
It was all lame puns for Thanksgiving. They showed this black and white picture of a family getting around the Thanksgiving table, and then it's spliced in with WWF footage. It's like, it's the Survivor Series. Expect some stuffing. How about some squash? As Yokozuna delivers the bonsai drop.
Clever.
Then they go to Vince McMahon and Heenan at ringside, and McMahon cuts a promo here saying, don't be fooled by anything trying to be the Survivor Series. There is only one event called the Survivor Series. This was a knock at War Games.
Oh, I see.
So Vince McMahon giving a bit of a fuck you to WCW here. So that was fun. What was not fun was our next match. Giant Gonzalez, accompanied by Harvey Whippleman, against The Undertaker in a rest-in-peace match, which meant no disqualification and no countout, and therefore they could brawl and use weapons because this match was going to be horrendous.
Okay.
And Whippleman, in some form or fashion, has taken possession of the urn of The Undertaker. And there's no Paul Bearer here. Taker hits two jumping clotheslines, but Gonzalez stays on his feet. And then gets tosses Taker to the floor. Gonzalez grabs a chair, delivers a shot to the ribs and back of Taker, and then throws Taker into the steps. And Taker tries to climb to his urn, but he cannot put any weight on his legs here. And the Undertaker's gong sound goes off, and Paul Bearer comes out with a black wreath. And Bear then clotheslines Harvey Whippleman on the floor, takes possession of the urn to a big reaction. And then Taker is laid out with a body slam, but Paul Bear holds the urn up, and this leads to The Undertaker sitting up. He hits a series of clotheslines, and then finally drops Gonzalez with a flying clothesline off the top rope, and that was the finish.
He fell.
Undertaker wins via fall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
sure.
And that was the end of Giant Gonzalez. I think he did a few house shows after this, and then he was gone.
Yeah, pretty much.
This guy was in bad shape even in 93, and he recently passed away, I think, within the last year and a half.
Yeah, in September, I think.
And they went to an argument afterwards where Gonzalez and Whippleman were arguing, and Gonzalez was upset the urn was gone and gives Whippleman the shortest choke slam in recorded history. I think Whippleman got 3 inches off the ground, very safe choke slam, and that was it for Giant Gonzalez. They didn't bother with any babyface run. He was done.
Yeah, that was it. No, it's just quite disappointing. Not much of an Andre the Giant.
More Joe Fowler. He's with Yokozuna, Jim Cornette, and Mr. Fuji. And Cornette complains about the Heavenly Bodies losing to the Steiners, and he starts getting red in the face, yelling here. And then Fowler talks about surprises tonight occurring, and that another surprise could be Luger taking the title. And Cornette, without even thinking, responds that Joe Fowler's employment is a surprise. And he cuts a promo on Luger, and it ends with Yokozuna yelling, "Banzai."
Yeah.
I love these, like, Cornette and Yokozuna together.
Absolutely.
Where Yoko never spoke, yelled Banzai.
Totally.
It's great.
Totally. Jim Cornette was just...
Very effective.
Yeah, he's a treasure.
A treasure. Up next, we got a six-man tag to Tonka and the Smoking Guns against Bam Bam Bigelow and the Head Shrinkers.
Your filler match of the...
God, evening. We didn't need this in here. This was killing time. Bigelow is accompanied by Luna. Offa's with the Head Shrinkers. And it begins with Tatanka and Bigelow. They get the heat on Tatanka. There's a mid-ring cross-body spot where both both run into each other. Builds to a hot tag to Billy Gunn. And Fatu delivers a super kick to Billy. They mention that Billy went to college on a rodeo scholarship and that him and Bart are real cowboys.
Okay.
Even rodeo. They're not real brothers. The heels work over Bart. There was a sign in the crowd that read, "Tatanka is dangerous tonight."
Tatanka is dangerous.
Someone spent time thinking of that. This is the best sign I can make for this pay-per-view. I'm against the hard camera. This is what I'm going to showcase to the world.
Tatanka is dangerous tonight. I'm sorry. I don't have the brain power to think of the reasoning.
They start attacking the head of Bart. They isolated the head of Bart and worked it over.
Okay.
And then they end up, Bigelow takes Bart's head and smashes it into Fatu and Samu's heads. And Fatu no-sells a face plant follow-up by Bart. Tatanka and Billy each come in for help, and each time Jimmy Cordero stops them from interfering. Bigelow finally misses an avalanche splash, and they get a hot tag to Tatanka, who delivers chops to the head of Bigelow. Hits a body slam, a DDT, a high cross off the top for a two count. Then goes into his warpath dance, but he's cut off with an enziguri from Bigelow. And then everyone gets into the ring. Billy's sent to the floor. It's 3-on-1 on Tatanka. And we see a splash by Bigelow to Tatanka in the corner. And then all three guys climb up to the top rope. They go for a triple headbutt off the top. And they all miss. Vince says the referee should be reprimanded for this careless officiating. And then all the heels... afterwards, we see two of them go to the floor. The Smoking Guns hit Pescados to the floor, and it leaves Tatanka in the ring with Samu, and he simply rolls up Samu for the win. Babyfaces get the victory.
Yeah, that was it. I was pretty sure in this match Vince didn't know which Head Shrinker was which. He kept calling Samu Fatu and vice versa.
These were not the Bellas in there. It was not that hard to tell them apart.
Yeah, and...
You hired these people. You pay them money.
He'd call one Samu, and then he'd call him Fatu the next sentence.
Well, they all look the same, I guess. That's what he was trying to imply.
Yeah, they do.
He then threw to who he referred to as broadcaster extraordinaire Joe Fowler, who is with Hank Carter, the driver of the Lex Express, who is in his bus watching the show on a monitor. This guy drives Lex Luger 9,000 miles around the country, and he can't even get a ticket to the event. He's got to sit out in the parking lot and watch this in his overheated bus.
By himself.
By himself!
Poor guy.
Hank Carter. And Fowler at the end says, I'm allowed one stupid question on each pay-per-view. Who do you like tonight? And I just wish that Josh Matthews could have as much fun when he's got to ask stupid questions like this every single pay-per-view. Listen to the questions next time of a WWE backstage interviewer and how really mind-blowing the questions are, how in-depth they are.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you feel about John Cena's actions tonight?
Yeah, yeah.
Then we go to Todd Pettengill, who's in the audience. He's doing his crazy voice, and he's with some fan named Bruce. And Bruce gave quite the representation of wrestling fans, where he's dressed up in this bed sheet, and Pettengill asks where he got this outfit from, and he says,
my mom went to Sears and made me a bedspread, sheets, and a pillowcase. What the heck? Make me an outfit.
You look great, my friend. USA, the crowd is going crazy. The action is hot and heavy here at SummerSlam.
My mom went to Sears and made me this outfit out of bed sheets. And it's got like vertical stripes of like blue, white, and red. So it looked like he was cheering on the Frenchman that is not competing on this show. That's what it looked like, a French flag.
Sure, why not?
I just did not scream USA.
I felt like this whole 20 to 30 minutes of content on this pay-per-view was just to kill time on this show.
Well, then we got a first. Howard Finkel asks everyone to please show respect for the Japanese national anthem from Kyotaka Suzuki.
Yes.
Who sang the anthem as the entire arena booed him.
This didn't even sound like an anthem. And I guarantee you, this was not even a professional singer. It just felt like they got some guy out there just singing random noises.
It was maybe a karaoke singer they got. This was incredibly offensive, I found.
I thought it was hilarious. It was very funny.
So,
well, come on, pro wrestling is offensive. Oh. You have to offend somebody to
I guess so. Watching this whole main event, it was like, for anyone outside of the U.S. watching this, how would you feel? If you were in Japan, Wei, watching this, how would you feel?
How do you feel?
You would hate this guy, Lex Luger.
Maybe, sure. Or maybe I would hate myself.
Because Yokozuna is from your country, even though he's from Hawaii, we hate all Japanese people, is what this crowd was saying.
Yeah, sure.
So,
anyway.
It continues onwards. Then they introduce the master of ceremonies, Randy Savage, who comes down with singer Aaron Neville. And Aaron Neville, who gets the Scott Putski Award for this event.
Really?
Did you see this guy's arms?
Not
really. Holy shit.
All right, Aaron Neville, Scott Putski winner. That's great.
And this was awesome because Vince is talking about how Randy Savage has been everything in the WWF, and now he's the master of ceremonies. Yeah, what a promotion. He's not even booked on this show. He's out to do the ring announcing.
He'll be the janitor next week.
Yep, he's done everything. He's headlined WrestleManias, and now he is doing the ring introductions. He's our Jeremy Borash. And the great part here was, as Aaron Neville is walking down with Savage, Vince McMahon, in his crazy voice, is yelling, Randy Savage and Darren Neville!
You're kidding me.
Nope. Here's the clip.
Macho Man Randy Savage, along with Darren Neville!
Darren Neville. And then Darren Neville sang the national anthem, and all I could think of was Jimmy Fallon and Justin Timberlake doing the their sketch together.
Uh-huh. I thought it was good.
Yeah. A stirring rendition, as Vince identified it as.
Yeah.
So Savage, then, talk about unbiased here. coming down to the ring, the new WWF champion Lex Luger.
He said that?
He said the soon-to-be WWF champion Lex Luger.
Wow.
How one-sided with it. Like, Yokozuna was the babyface to me by the start of this match.
If you
This is too much.
Yeah, sure.
Way too much. And finally, we get to the match after all of this unnecessary American patriotism. We get to the match, Yokozuna and Lex Luger for the WWF Championship. And this matchup kicks off with a stare down, and they exchange words. And as Luger's back's turned, Mr. Fuji, who knows how old this man was at the time, starts creeping up the steps and into the ring behind Luger's back. This was the least menacing attack tease I have ever seen. What was Fuji going to do if Luger did not turn around?
Yell at him.
Like this old man coming to attack Luger from behind. Yokozuna misses a leg drop, and it leads to leg kicks by Luger. He then crotches Yokozuna by kicking the second ropes into Yokozuna. Fuji tries to throw salt, but Luger catches him. Yokozuna with the advantage. He's choking Luger with a cable on the floor. He splashes him against the post, and then he goes to hit Luger with a chair against the post, but Luger gets out of the way, so Yokozuna hits the post. Luger climbs to the top rope. He nearly fell on, like, two occasions here. Hit a double axe handle onto Yokozuna, who stays standing.
They do that spot, like, at least three times on this show, where the giant can't fall down.
Yeah, they did.
With Borga, with Giant Gonzalez, and
a lot of giants here. Then we see a forearm from the top, and Yokozuna falls for a near fall. Then we get a follow-up clothesline to the back of Yokozuna's head. Yokozuna then attacks Luger with the bucket from Mr. Fuji as the referee is distracted, but Luger kicks out for a pop. Then we see a belly-to-belly suplex delivered by Yokozuna, and as soon as this move occurs, it's like Vince completely loses faith in Lex Luger. He just starts saying,
"Unbelievable side suplex! Almost broke him in half! And that should do it! And again, this ladies and gentlemen, a valiant effort! 1, 2, 3! No! He still didn't get him! He still did not get him!"
It was this ridiculous, like, selling by Vince. He was just such a cartoon announcer.
This whole world is a cartoon.
Dramatic.
This whole world is a cartoon.
Yokozuna then put pressure on the trapezius muscle of Luger. Long rest spot. Luger gets to his feet. Goes for a body slam, but Yokozuna lands on top for a two count. Leg drop for another two. And then Yokozuna sets him up for the bonsai drop. And Heenan says, "Bonsai! The big one! Hiroshima!"
Mm-hmm.
Holy fuck. But he misses Luger with the bonsai drop. Then Yokozuna misses a running back slam. He gets body slammed by Luger. Fuji is knocked out. Luger then exposes his forearm, and he knocks Yokozuna to the floor, who is out cold. He decks Cornette on the apron, and Yokozuna is counted out, and Luger celebrates like he has conquered the world here. And Vince just keeps saying, "He won the match! He's done the impossible! He's won the match!" And the Steiners and Tatanka come out to celebrate.
What idiots.
Are you not familiar with the rules of professional wrestling? What have you accomplished here? You failed. And finally, just seamlessly, Vince transitions into...
"You can bet Lex Luger will get his rematch. You can bet there will be so much pressure on WWF President Jack Tunney. You can bet that Lex Luger will get his rematch, and when he does, Lex Luger will not only defeat Yokozuna, Lex Luger will be the World Wrestling Federation champion."
Like, he got his championship call-in without Luger winning the title.
Yeah, I know.
What an anticlimactic finish here.
Yeah, you just lost the title, you idiot. But with the confetti and with all that, I guess they were... This was an exercise in basically fucking people around with bells and whistles to get them to give you the reaction that they want. It's like, you can announce... your dog just died, but then have a celebration with a cake and I don't know, lots of great music, and hopefully you'll cheer it. Bad example.
So they celebrated, and I were confused as to what they were celebrating, but they did a huge, like, the same kind of reception you would do if this guy just won the title.
Oh, like exactly what they did with Brett at WrestleMania 10 afterwards. But I actually enjoyed this match. I thought these two surprisingly worked pretty well together. It had the feel of a big, you know, atmosphere type of match, similar to a Hulk Hogan main event. I love Yokozuna as a heel. He just had a spectacular look, and I thought all his offense looked great. And it seemed to drag a bit towards the middle. You could tell they got a bit tired, but overall I was impressed by these two.
So that was SummerSlam 1993.
Did you watch the music video that came afterwards?
No, I didn't.
There was a music video set to the song called "I'll Be Your Hero."
Oh,
it starts off. It starts off with a shot of a bus.
I know the song.
Coming into the foreground, from a distance on a road, and it's the Lex Express, and this footage of this bus coming onwards is superimposed with footage of the moon landing, of John F. Kennedy. Of Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, and Lex Luger.
The next linear extension of those figures.
Absolutely.
Of course.
So you just get a montage of the Lex Express and all the touring, coupled with the shots of the match, his body slam, and eventually his count-out victory.
Amazing. I can honestly say that, you know, it's fun covering wrestling in this day and age, but man, if we were doing this in 93, you know how much fun it would be?
Absolutely it would be. Yeah, sure. I think...
imagine covering this. This was what was going on in like WWF in the early 90s.
Wait a second. This still goes on. This stuff still goes on today.
That's true. We do get some really cheesy shit at times.
We got an anti... We had James Storm calling Anarchia a lawnmower on Impact this week. Anyway, what are your thoughts about the Lex Express, and why did they not execute the title change?
I never... Like, it was obviously a big reaction. They lost Hulk Hogan. They wanted to create a new star. And they Lex Luger was put into that spot.
As opposed to Brett.
And I guess they wanted the big American babyface star, and Vince wanted to go with a guy with a big look. But to me, it was like Luger never got over to a giant degree. And this guy was given the biggest push, like, in years in this company. I mean, they went all out for this guy. And come SummerSlam, like, I can't disagree with them keeping it on Yokozuna. I enjoyed Yokozuna. I thought that year he had the title. He was this big, menacing heel that no one could beat. I thought he was a great character at that time. He hadn't let his weight get out of control crazy. And was, you know, for a guy that size, I mean, fuck, I thought he was the better worker in that main event. I mean, the guy could move for a guy of that size.
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
This guy isn't doing moonsaults, but fuck, he was, like, agile for his weight. It was incredible when you consider this guy was over 400 pounds. So I don't disagree with that decision at all. I just never thought Luger would have clicked as a top guy.
Yeah.
All right, let's get into everybody's feedback. We'll start off with Kenny Soto. I do remember going nuts when Lex slammed Yokozuna, but even as a 7-year-old, I never got the Lex hype. I was pissed when he tied Brett at the Royal Rumble, and I wanted Crush to kick his ass. Has Lex ever done anything great in wrestling besides being on Nitro and Raw at the same time? He was not on Nitro and Raw at the same time. That was Rick Rude. But Luger worked a series of WWF house shows one weekend and then showed up on the first Nitro.
Mark Robinson, I never saw this event until many, many years later, until I finally found a VHS copy on eBay. I thought it was a meh event, to say the least, but not as bad as I've heard some call it. The matches that stand out to me the most are Bret Hart working twice that night, first in a pretty good match against Heel Doink, then again right after against Jerry Lawler, where he pretty much beat the shit out of the King. I thought HBK versus Mr. Perfect was okay, but nowhere near as good as you'd expect it to be. Sean says in his book that their styles were almost too similar, and it hurt the match. Plus, I never thought that Kurt Hennig worked as well as a babyface. The Lex Luger versus Yokozuna match was what you'd expect it to be, but the dumb ending is what I remember more. They had built up Lex Luger that whole summer, only for him to win with a lame countout finish, after which they celebrate like he'd just won the title with the balloons and confetti.
Overall, not an awful event, but not a good one either. I'd give it about 4.5 out of 10.
Dean Kusulis. Even as a kid watching this show, it just left a bad taste in my mouth. Shawn Michaels versus Mr. Perfect could have been a five-star classic, but with Perfect working as a face and his injuries mounting up, instead we got a decent match, nothing more. Luger winning by countout would have been fine for a house show, but the simple fact was that he was celebrating like he won the title, complete with faces coming out with him. Felt very anticlimactic. Heel Doink was always a pleasure to watch, and it was sad seeing the Million Dollar Man have his last match with the company. Overall, a 5 out of 10.
Yannick Fortier. God, was the Heavenly Bodies Steiner match good by 1993 standards? I now get why Mr. Pollock got yelled at by Steiner recently. He does have a legacy to protect. The rest? Meh. So 3 out of 10 for this match alone. Does anybody else know why Bruce and Owen were there for the end of the Lawler-Brett match? Was it to build up to the Survivor Series? I could check it out on Wikipedia, but I guess I'm too lazy to do so.
Oh yeah, they wanted the family involved, and that's exactly where they were going for a Survivor Series. And the plan was at one point to use to eventually build to a Hart family feud. So yeah, that was the next pay-per-view, and I guarantee they had that booked out in advance. Scott Davidson, I was at the show live, and how over the Steiner brothers were. The main event was what it was. Seemed to be a huge letdown from all of the hype Luger had, and a win by countout didn't make a lot of sense at the time.
Ryan Daniels.
With an essay.
Yes, I've never seen this event until now. Beyond the main event on an episode of Vintage Collection. I didn't think it was a particularly bad SummerSlam, but then again, I'm partial to any and all classic WWF. Not all pay-per-views may have been the most riveting, but they all bring something to the table and all weave the tapestry that is the history of the WWF. The version I've seen included the Countdown Show, which included Todd Pettengill in a house with a SummerSlam magazine and a bowl of Fritos, freaking out over the cameraman trying to sit on the couch and showing off his clean fireplace. It was weird seeing the Steiners' mother and sister at ringside before their match. Jim Cornette, clearly the most entertaining aspect of the tag team title match, and the match itself wasn't bad. Very impressive watching Scott Steiner deliver a standing Hurricanrana off the ropes to win the match. Bobby Heenan seemed in good form commentating this event with Vince. Another entertaining aspect of this pay-per-view was Joe Fowler handing interviews backstage. He reminded me a lot of Mike Adamley with his innocent enthusiasm, except he without the mistakes. Don't know how long he lasted there, but pity he wasn't around to interview Art Donovan 10 months later at King of the Ring.
I didn't mind Joe Fowler. I think I could have, the guy could have grown on me. We go to Steve Kassan. John and Wade, do you know the reason behind not giving the title to Luger? Was it because they felt he didn't have it? No. Was it because they felt he didn't have it? No faith? Or did he just piss someone off backstage? You have this tremendous build-up with the Lex Express, only to have the American hero win via countout, whilst the Japanese enemy keeps the title. Something is foul here. At the time, I believe the deal was that they felt they could prolong this and eventually build to WrestleMania with Luger's big title win, and they were wrong.
Kevin Jeffrey. This was the first WWF pay-per-view I ever attended. The event itself was okay, but the countdown finish for the main event didn't make sense at the time, considering how much time had been put into the Lex Express and hype surrounding Luger. Michaels, Mr. Perfect, was the best match of the night. 4 out of 10 for the night. Paid $20 for my third row seat, so I got my money's worth for the night. At the time, I thought it was a great event, but over time, you were better to see, to put events in perspective.
What was the, what did you think was the best match on this card?
I think it would have been, I really enjoyed the combination of the Brett segments, but I might have gone with Perfect and Sean as well, actually, yeah.
Hank Wheelcrank. I've been a fan of the show for about a year, but have not added you guys on Facebook because I work in a professional environment, aka one where everyone is up their own ass, and wanted to keep my wrestling fandom a secret for fear of not being taken seriously at work. The past month of wrestling has been the best in a decade. I ordered Money in the Bank, and it's the first non-WrestleMania pay-per-view I've purchased in 10 years. This excitement has caused me to create an alternative account so I can participate in feedback. After Monday, I need an outlet for my enthusiasm. I like the tournament for the belt because, okay, this has nothing to do with SummerSlam, but, oh, sorry, I didn't see the next one here. Haven't seen SummerSlam, but I'm really looking forward to the review. Well, thank you very much, Hank. I'm glad you created a brand new account to inform us of that.
Zulani. Part of the problems that the WWF faced during this time had to do with the kind of finishes we saw in the SummerSlam main event. They always had the ability to build guys up, yet they didn't seem to have the faith to follow through. Earlier that year, Razor Ramon had headlined the Royal Rumble in a WWF Championship match against Bret, but within a year, the main event monster heel had become a mid-card babyface. Lex Luger also suffered somewhat of the same fate. It boggles the mind as to why Vince didn't just follow through on the hype that they'd built. Having Lex win the belt at SummerSlam, giving him a strong run, and then making him face Bret one-on-one at WrestleMania 10 would have made a more compelling and probably higher-drawing main event. Within a year, Lex had lost his steam and was involved in the forgettable mid-card you-sold-out angle with Tatanka and Ted DiBiase. SummerSlam 93 was an average show that should have had a better finish.
I don't know. I don't disagree with their decision to not go with Luger. I don't think he would have been a tremendous option as champion. He was great chasing it, but I don't think he would have done very well with the title. Atish Singh. Ah, yes, the good old Lex Express. I remember the lead-up to this pay-per-view with the narcissist body-slamming Yokozuna on the USS Intrepid to become the All-American. Luger had so much momentum going into SummerSlam, and the young hardcore wrestling fan in me totally expected him to win the WWF title. I was shocked when he didn't, and surprised when they did the whole celebration at the end. I remember Bret finally getting to destroy Lawler after he attacked him at the King of the Ring with what seemed like a 10-minute sharpshooter. Not a great pay-per-view, as SummerSlam usually had good matches before this, especially the IC title matches. Love all the reviews, guys. Keep it up. And hey, John, my girlfriend thinks that you and Renee Paquette would make a beautiful couple. LOL. Any chance of reviewing SummerSlam 89 soon? Thanks again. SummerSlam 89. I don't think we reviewed that one.
I don't think so either. Care to comment on the other?
No. I'm,
John taken. Is unavailable. Neither is Renee, from what I hear. I'm not sure. Joe Bray. I'm just after watching the event in full for the first time and felt that the whole show was underwhelming due to the number of countouts and DQs on the show. Shawn versus Perfect was okay, but not great. The Steiners were a great team back in 93. Scott especially was a great worker back then, and the match against the Bodies was a good bout. The 1-2-3 Kids promo before the match was hilarious. I thought he was going to have a nervous breakdown. Also, who the fuck is Joe Fowler? Never heard of the guy. He was 10 times worse than Pettengill anyway.
No way.
And that's saying something. Bret was the best worker in North America in 93 and was probably shit on even though he won the King of the Ring and was having great matches with guys like Bigelow and Razor. At least that changed in 94. As for Lex being pushed as the main guy, I felt he was pushed down people's throats too much and people got tired of seeing another American hero. The main event was really anticlimactic with everybody coming out and celebrating over a DQ win. Overall, I'd give the show a 4 out of 10.
A lot of people complaining about the finish of the main event. Jay Hunter, can you imagine if this year's SummerSlam main event ended in a countout? There'd be murder. I never liked Lex Luger. Besides his obvious deficits, I found the pro-USA gimmick to be really phony. Much like Angle or even Hogan or Jim Duggan, patriotism needs to be part of your character straight away, not shoehorned in after a failed heel run. Mm-hmm. I don't see why WWF didn't give Luger the title for even a couple of months, though. They wanted Luger as the top babyface, so why not? I found the whole Lex experiment quite messy. WWF failed to commit themselves to Luger, and so did the fans. Maybe Vince wanted to see if the Hulkamania gimmick would work with someone else. I'm sure if he had a time machine, he would have gone with Luger getting the title at SummerSlam. That said, if he had a time machine, Luger wouldn't be in the match.
Jason Perez. The Lex Express was a dumb gimmick. I hated it. McMahon was trying to create the next Hogan. I liked Luger better when he first debuted as the narcissist with Heenan as his manager. Overall, I never liked Lex. I was happy when he lost the WCW title to Hogan at Bash at the Beach 97, only holding it for 6 days. Can't wait to hear your review. I don't remember much of that show other than the main event. Glad Yokozuna kept the title.
Go to Brian Hillhouse. I assume that since Lex is on this show, he will be the Scott Putski winner. No, he's not. We're giving it to Aaron Neville. Might I suggest that after someone has won the honor a certain number of times, they enter the Putski Award Hall of Fame and become ineligible to win again, thus giving others a shot at the award? Well, if they've put this much commitment into their look, I think they should be recognized for it.
I agree with you. Chad Rivera. I agree with the previous comments before about being confused about Lex Luger not winning the title after they built him up as strong as America's only hope against the evil Yokozuna. I also hated the DQ finish of the match. Another booking decision that made absolutely no sense was the 1-2-3 Kid getting beat fairly easy by the IRS. Kid was coming into this pay-per-view strong with wins over Razor and DiBiase on previous Raws. This being his first pay-per-view, they totally killed any momentum he had on furthering his status in the company and knocking him down the card. Why exactly did IRS need to win? What upside is there to it to have him go over instead of the Kid?
Yeah, I disagreed with the 1-2-3 Kid, Matt. That made no sense to me with a guy like IRS, just like a nothing mid-card heel. Alan Gaynor, this was a fantastically promoted main event. It may seem hard to believe that people were actually looking forward to a Luger vs. Yokozuna main event, but they were. They shot the big angle, then kept them apart for 6 weeks or so, and it really worked. The match itself had a pretty terrible finish, but it had great heat. The rest of the matches were average or slightly better. The Steiners vs. Heavenly Bodies match was probably the best on the show. I remember that it was first or second runner-up in Pro Wrestling Illustrated's Match of the Year fan balloting. As for the Lex Express, it was the greatest six-passenger or more vehicle in the history of sports entertainment, with all due respect to Randy Orton's bus and Vince's airplane.
Corey Ferreira, first off, John and Way, really enjoyed the SummerSlam 03 episode and your mini Metallica discussion. Now on to SummerSlam 93. Despite where the WWF was at this point, they did a good job promoting Lex Luger as a big star and tried to make him the next major star for the company in a gimmick similar to Hogan's. If Vince and the WWF put all that effort into promoting Luger with the bus tour across the U.S., why waste the match with Yokozuna with a DQ finish? It makes the entire promotion of the event a waste in my eyes. Overall, the event was nothing special. The real star of the company in Bret Hart works with Doink only 2 months after King of the Ring, but his second match with Lawler continued their long-running program. Michaels and Perfect should have been great, but it wasn't, which is a shame, because they could have had a great match together.
I think that they were trying to push that this was, you know, it would have been better had Yokozuna been undefeated at this point, and just the fact that he beat this monster was a feat in and of itself. But unfortunately, that Hogan WrestleMania 9 finish kind of took that away as well. And let's finish off with Nate Milton. I'm really looking forward to your review of SummerSlam 93 as I was not watching the product at the time. I've always heard that this was one of the weaker SummerSlams. Just looking at the card, the two countout finishes jump out at me. And with guys like Ludwig Borga, Marty Jannetty, and Giant Gonzalez collecting pay-per-view paychecks, I can see why WWF fans have a negative feeling about the show. My bigger problem with the WWF at this time was the treatment of Lex Luger. I know fans like to bash the guy, but he was tailor-made for success in the WWF. He had the look, he had a passable level of charisma, and he could actually put on a good match with the right opponent. I don't know if this was the case of Vince not wanting to put the belt on a guy he didn't create, or if Luger had heat backstage, but I think they really dropped the ball on a lot of outside talent during that time period. Think about it. Within a 5-year span, the WWF had Lex Luger, Kerry Von Erich, and Ric Flair, and really didn't do anything with them. In fact, the only good thing to come out of Luger's WWF run, besides slamming Yokozuna on the deck of a battleship, was his triumphant return to WCW on the premiere edition of Monday Nitro. As I said, I don't think it was, you know, not having confidence in Luger. I think they were just hoping that, you know, Luger chasing the title was meant more money than putting the title on him and him, you know, doing rematches with Yokozuna. I mean, also look at it this way. Had you taken the title off Luger outside of your rematch program with Yokozuna, what heels were ready for a main event program with Luger?
No one was really ready. They're setting up Borga here for a feud.
But this guy just started. I mean, that's quite... Yeah. And Luger and Borga in a main event?
Yeah.
That's kind of scary, to be honest.
Sure.
And Borga was a guy that didn't even last very long. He was gone by the early part of 94. So that's going to wrap up our feedback, everybody. But as promised, we have our chat with Lex Luger. This took place May of 2010 on The Law. A very very engaging interview here with Lex Luger. Some 17 years after the 93 SummerSlam. So here he is, Lex Luger, in conversation with Dan Lavransky.
Lex, before we get into the stuff here, I just want to get an update on your health, because I know you had a lot of issues over the last few years. You had the problems with your spine and walking and your arms and legs. And just how's Lex Luger doing at this moment?
Oh, I'm doing my health is... Hang on, guys, one second. My phone. My health is doing phenomenal. I'm made a, against all odds, from the prognosis that all the top neurologists at Stanford Medical initially and Shepherd Center here in Atlanta, world-class facility, said that I was going to need 24-hour care the rest of my life and be fed and picked out of bed with a net and put into a power chair and ramps at my house. And it's phenomenal what's happened. I'm very thankful for what God's done with his hearing power of him, and also the incredible medical help I've had here in Atlanta through the Shepherd Center and the rehab and the doctors and nurses. In fact, guys, it's just been phenomenal against all odds, and even the doctors can't really explain it. So I'm just extremely thankful.
Wow.
It's incredible.
Wow. And now is part of this recovery also, because I know you've hooked up again with Diamond Dallas Page and you're involved with the yoga and stuff now, right?
Yeah, he's actually been an integral part. I do hydrotherapy. I do land training, but also the YRG is at Dallas, and I have really part of what looked like it's a tragedy, this injury. Part of the amazing things, a triumph of it, has been a lot of the reconnections that I've been able to make in wrestling again. And Dallas has just been phenomenal. He's flown in from L.A., giving me like one-on-one instruction, and him and I have restruck up an amazing friendship, and he'll be here for a promo last defend in Atlanta this weekend. We're looking forward to him coming to town. His yoga, the YRG, has been a tremendous help in my recovery.
Nice.
I'm very thankful to Dallas as well.
Now, you've been very open, Lex, over the last few years because of the injuries and what's happened and the use of steroids and other drugs during your career. Do you look back now with regret, or is it kind of, would you have changed anything? Like, how do you feel about that whole thing after going through all this intense injury and recovery?
Well, I look at it as an opportunity to share with others that some of the decisions we make earlier on in our life. I'll try to go around, give a lot of motivational and inspirational talks to especially the young people out there. And so I try to really utilize my past and decisions that I've made in my life and the impact they had on me physically and other ways to try to show them there's a better way to do things now. So I'm really, to be honest with you guys, I'm thankful for that as well, that God and others can utilize that to impact other people's lives now.
Now, so following from that, Lex, if young wrestling people that want to get into wrestling, people that are trying to get in, what advice would you offer them in terms of that? Because we all know how important the body is in pro wrestling.
Well, I think they monitor things a lot more closely in wrestling now, as far as how many days and events the guys wrestle. In my day, we used to wrestle over 3 nights a year sometimes, and sometimes I'd do 3 or 4 matches at a taping at Disney or something. So a lot of times I'd have 400 matches in a year. I think physically they monitor more closely now. I know that WWE, and I don't know what TNA does, but they are they have a wellness program, and they really counsel the guys before they get out on the road and try to steer them clear of making bad decisions with drugs, alcohol, how they conduct themselves, but also any performance-enhancing drugs. Because now the exciting part for me is I'm involved in sports nutrition and wellness counseling, health and those aspects are very important, and I'll be sharing with others. And it's wonderful what our young athletes now can achieve through research and development into safe supplements, the creatines and the glutamines, and just how to eat properly for athletes now. And I'm very excited that the advancements you made in that, so the athletes don't feel like they have to resort to, nor do I think there's pressure from above or corporately if you have to look a certain way to be successful in wrestling, because there's all shapes and sizes now, from Rey Mysterio to Big Show. And I really am excited about that aspect of wrestling for our current young guys out there now.
Well, let's take a look at some of the highlights and moments from your career, Lex, because, I mean, it truly was amazing. You were all over the place. I mean, I wanted to get some of your thoughts. I mean, what was going through your mind when you got to be part of, like, the Four Horsemen, at when they were at, like, their peak as a group of characters? I mean, that must have been just absolutely an amazing part of your career.
Oh, it's hard to even describe in words. I didn't quite realize at the time, because when I got a football, I'd never really watched wrestling. The first match I ever was actually live at an event was the one I wrestled in at my debut. And I'd been in training school, but never been to a live wrestling event. And the opportunity I got a year into my career to become a Four Horseman, I had never seen the show, TBS. I was at World Championship Wrestling. I didn't realize what a huge following and what an enormously impactful group of bad guys at Four Horsemen were, to be able to flow in my first year in wrestling in with Ric Flair and Arn Anderson, Tully Blanchard, and it was an incredible opportunity at the time. Amazing.
Did you face a lot of flack coming in because you didn't really come from a pro wrestling background? I mean, you really came more from a bodybuilding thing. Was that tough to overcome at first?
Well, my background was really football, but at the time I came in with the success Hogan had, and a few of the guys that were coming in, that Ultimate Warrior, that wrestling was turning into a global entity, and with what WWE was doing and what WWF at the time, and they were looking for a different type of athlete. I didn't realize at the time, but what a blessing it was for me to enter at that time with my type of physique coming out of from football. And then I always had a real passion, love for working out at the gym. So in combination that, I had the height and the look and things they were really looking for at the time. And that really skyrocketed my career, like the 4th of July. And I had like a 15-year career that never went out. It's amazing the career I had in those 15 years. It really is, looking back on it.
Was when you met up with the Horsemen in that first year, and you're with, you know, talents like Flair and Arn and J.J. Dillon and those guys, Tully Blanchard, was there any one thing, or what was the most important thing that you learned from those guys? Because, I mean, really, that would have been like going to wrestling school.
Oh, every night was like going to wrestling school. And like Arn and Tully were like the masters of crowd psychology, but also especially in the tag team aspect. I mean, it was amazing to be in tag matches or six mans with them. Flair was the master of the singles match, as always defending the world title, and JJ was an extraordinary psychologist in interviews and as a leader and manager of the team. You're absolutely right. It was a tremendous learning opportunity for me.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about the period in WCW where Ric Flair actually left and he went to the WWF, and you were actually made champion, but you were heel champion at the time with Harley Race. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that period, because really most of the time you worked as a babyface, and I just wanted to get, plus the pressure that was probably put on you to lead the company as world champion.
Well, I didn't feel the pressure so much, because there really wasn't any, he was gone, there wasn't anybody. I kind of fell into it, but they gave me a lot of support with Harley Race there. I mean, Harley Race is not only a very dear friend, but an extraordinary source. And I felt very confident taking on the role, even though it was as a heel, with Harley Race at my side. They really brought him in there to coach and counsel and groom me, and He was a tremendous asset. He really was.
Now, I also want to talk about that time in the WWE when you got the huge push. We had the Lex Express. You slammed Yokozuna on the battleship there.
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been in a time in your career when you just were on top of the world.
Man, when we did that thing on 4th of July in the Intrepid, the reaction of the crowd when I came off the helicopter, and I'll tell you, knowing to this day, when it comes to promoting and marketing and building something up, does it like Vince McMahon at WWE. I mean, that was the slam run around the world, and that crowd went insane, and the bus tour and the crowds that turned out for that were absolutely phenomenal. What a well-planned, well-marketed tour, and I really did literally tour the country in a bus from, and did appearances like 5 in the morning on wake-up radio and and TV all the way through to the weather at 5 in the afternoon. I mean, appearances at malls. I mean, they planned every minute of the tour, and it was just so well done. I really did literally tour the whole country in a bus. It really was, looking back on it, a fantastic experience.
Now, I also wanted to get your thoughts, Lex, because you worked in that era when there were a lot of, like, legitimate tough guys in pro wrestling. I know you've talked about Rick Rude because worked with him early on in Florida and stuff. But of all the different guys that you worked with through the years, who were the guys that were, like, really legitimate tough guys?
There's so many of them. I couldn't name them all. But the king of the heap. The guys are always the toughest of the toughest. Everybody in the business and the wrestling sport knew it were the Island Boys, like Haku and Barbarian. Nobody messed with the Island Boys in the locker room, guys. They were amongst the baddest guys around. They were the baddest of the bad. Always have been and still are.
Wow. Well,
those Island Boys are tough hombres. Don't get that. You don't want to get on their bad side. They're great guys, but, man, you don't ever want to get on their bad side.
I wanted to ask you about, obviously, Bruiser Brody, too, because there's that legendary story of you and him having the cage match in Florida where it appears he just kind of stops working with you, and you got out of the cage. You got out of the cage pretty quick.
I was scared to death. That was one big, scary-looking guy with that hair. He's like 6'6 and 320, and I just started wrestling. I thought I'd really done something wrong in a match. And they couldn't get the gate open fast enough. I climbed over the top. I was so scared to get out of there.
Well, what was the issue? Why wouldn't Brody cooperate with you?
Well, it wasn't so much. I'm sure I was young and inexperienced and was kind of not doing things the right way. And we'd had a long day. We'd taped TV in Tampa early. We'd all driven to Miami. The match was in Fort Lauderdale. And he just said afterwards, I was scared to go over the other locker room on the other side. It was the backstage. I go, well, I guess I better go up and take my beating if that's what he's going to do. And he was totally nonchalant and just Engelbert Humperdinck at the time was his manager. And he said, I figured it's okay if I come in. He goes, yeah, come on in. And he just said, look, I'm on TV in Dallas right now as a good guy, and I'm supposed to be a bad guy here tonight. You just got on TV on TBS and off of Florida as a bad guy going in with the horse. He goes, just wasn't working tonight. And he was just real nonchalant about it. And I asked him, what did I do? I'm sorry. And I was very apologetic. He said, don't worry about it. He goes, just wasn't working.
Wow. All right.
He was definitely a different kind of guy.
Well, no, that's for sure. That's for sure. You know, Brody was one of a kind. There's no doubt about that.
No doubt.
Yeah, no doubt.
He was a tremendous talent, though. I mean, man, he had a... Whoa, he did some crazy stuff, and he definitely got the crowd's attention.
Yeah, are you surprised that he came to the end that he did with what happened with him in Puerto Rico being murdered in the...
Well, as much as he scared me in that cage match, it's a tragedy that he had stabbed to death by another guy, but that guy probably was pretty darn scared for some reason. I don't know the whole story.
Yeah,
though.
No, obviously.
He was a big intimidating guy. No doubt.
Now we've been going over all these various parts of your career here. One of the other ones I have to touch on as well is that fateful Nitro. You showed up on the very first Nitro. You wrestled in the WWF. I believe it was a Canadian date the Sunday, and then the Monday night you were on the Nitro. Tell us how that all unfolded.
Yeah, I was in Moncton, New Brunswick. The people don't realize that there was a 90-day notice with contracts for WWE at the time. That my contract, when I had 90-day notice to let Vince know whether or not you were going to let your contract automatically roll over for another year was needed to be served in November. I served my 90-day notice wanting to work out a deal with him. Him wanting to work out a deal with me. In February, my contract expired. So from February through September, when that first Nitro match came down head-to-head Monday night, I was working, which it's incredible now to look back on. It was a risk for me and for Vince under no type of contract with WWE. I had a casual conversation with Sting, who him and I have always have been and remain best of friends to this day. An amazing guy and great friend. And he, in conversation 2 weeks prior to the first Monday Nitro, said, it came up in conversation. I wasn't under contract. And Sting goes, wait a second. You're wrestling for WWE and you're on their TV and you're under contract. I go, no, my contract expired back in February. He goes, you got to be kidding me. So he called Eric Bischoff, who wasn't really much of a big Lex Luger fan, but Eric saw an opportunity and said, well, if you won't give your notice, which was the way I was brought into wrestling and the respect you're supposed to have for it and who you work for, he said, if you don't give any notice, I'd like to bring you in for the first Monday show. I go, you mean not tell Vince I'm leaving and give him notice? He goes, no, that's part of the deal. And at the time, I tried so hard and long to work out a deal with Vince. I said, I felt at the time, even though I didn't feel good about it, that I needed to do what was best for my family and for my career. So I went from a Sunday night show, unbeknownst to everyone, even in the day, the internet was already running rampant. That's why they wanted to be secret. And they snuck me into the Mall of America under a hood and brought me out there. It was probably one of the last complete surprises in wrestling, I think.
Yeah, no, it was a major one, that is for sure. You mentioned Sting. You're good friends with Sting after all these years. I wanted to get some of your thoughts about TNA and the product at the moment, because Sting, very much a big part of it, really one of the top guys, Hogan, Bischoff in there. Should these guys still be on top in a promotion, or has their day come and gone? I mean, just I wanted to get from your perspective what you see when I turn on the TV in 2010 and there's Sting and Hogan and Flair. Well,
I think wrestling persona with the makeup and the paint, the outfit he wears is pretty timeless. I think the other guys, I've always believed this, to sum it up. The fans, I've always chosen the stars and made the stars. And the other side, if these guys have stayed in the ring too long, I think the ratings will reflect that. And if they have, if they're trying to do one time too many, the fans have always really, in spite of what we try to do with storylines and everything else, the fans pretty much make the final decision. So I think over time here, if there's one last run or one last angle with these stars that have been stars for so many decades, is possible the ratings will affect that, and if not, I think the ratings will affect that as well. So I think the time will tell, and probably fairly quickly.
Yeah, well, I think you're right there, certainly, because the ratings, I don't think, are going anywhere near what TNA was expecting with these guys. So we could see some changes there very, very quickly. Lex, I want to thank you for joining us so late here on a Sunday night. If I just wanted to get out of you, because, again, we've talked about all these great moments in your career. For you, Lex Luger, is there any one, like, personal, I don't know, maybe match or angle or something from your career that you just go, that's the moment for me?
Well, the Four Horsemen obviously was the slamming around the world, but I'd say another moment, I think you might have played it live as we did the lead in here, you guys. So
were you on the title there?
In Detroit, when Hogan out of the blue came into the back and said that he wanted to put the world title on me, and at the height of the NWO thing, it was a real sign of respect from him as a co-worker, and it was a total shock. And the crowd in Detroit was totally, because Hogan had never lost on anything but a pay-per-view, because it's a small audience.
Yeah.
He had never lost live on a cable show like that with millions of viewers, and the fans at home, and also the crowd in Detroit, they went bananas. So that was, a real highlight as well. If I had to pick one of so many highlights in my career.
So that was Lex Luger discussing a lot of his issues, a lot of the highlights of his career, a lot of the lowlights of his career, and some very interesting stuff. So I just wanted to share that. Obviously, Luger front and center on this pay-per-view, and I thought that was a really well-done interview we did last year. So that is going to wrap us up for this week, everyone. Of course, we are going to be back Monday night with Review a Raw, which you can listen live at reviewaway.com. On the left-handed side, there's a link to listen live, where we go on live at midnight Eastern time and are interacting with people and taking feedback as the show goes on. And, of course, Review and Impact coming up on Friday. And Mr. Ting, looking ahead to next week, I believe is my selection for an event. And next week, I believe, will be episode number 98 for Review Away.
Is that right?
I believe.
Wow.
Right around that area. I think we're about to hit 100.
98. Jesus, we have to pick a big one for 100.
Yeah, big 100.
Yeah.
So next week, we're coming off Money in the Bank, everyone, which everyone is just talking about being one of the best shows in company history. And there's an event that they've been comparing this to, and it's an event I've actually never seen. And that is the July 1997 In Your House Canadian Stampede event. And
wow.
I thought of this event after Money in the Bank, and Bruce Hart clinched this for me on SummerSlam 93. So next week we'll take a look at a two-hour WWF pay-per-view event, Canadian Stampede, which was right when the company was really starting to heat up with the USA-Canada angle, and this is one of the best pay-per-views in company history. So maybe we can review it and contrast it to Money in the Bank and what they're doing right now.
This is one I'm definitely very much looking forward to.
Yes, a solid event to review. So that's going to be coming up next week here on the program. And Wei, you can end us off here with a song selection.
My song selection, my choice of this week is a very important one. It is Kyotaka Suzuki's rendition of the Japanese national anthem as sung on this pay-per-view.
Here it is, Kyotaka Suzuki, real name Jimmy Suzuki.
Is that right?
It is.
Wow.
Performing the Japanese national anthem amidst boos from Auburn Hills, Michigan.
At this time, would you please show some respect as Mr. Kyotaka Suzuki sings the Japanese national anthem.
Sort of a partisan crowd here.
Stadium, you might say, Bobby Heenan.